Today, clouds and silver linings. The DFA Daily to the 20th of June 2020. Hello again, I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics, one of the latest posts covering finance and property news with a distinctively Australian flavour and a dash of philosophy on the side. In today's post, we'll look at what the Fed is doing, the latest local retail figures, there's more on those horrible job rates, low-paid workers may get a small pay rise thanks to the latest Fair Work Commission, and the hedonic index is back. The Fed dropped their balance sheet by 1% this week, just the fourth week down this year, and the first, post-COVID, down $74 billion to $7.09 trillion. So just up 78.6% or $3.3 trillion since the repo blew up back in September. Bearing in mind the Fed was supporting the financial markets and the whole system by injecting more liquidity, this might just signal a change of direction, despite it announcing that it will be purchasing corporate bonds. And by the way, we think that is unnecessary, as we discussed in a recent post. But what if this signals that the Fed is turning to supporting the real economy by, for example, the PPP programs, rather than the financial system? If so, then the markets, which have had a massive run-up since their lows of just over a month ago, could be set for a fall. So perhaps this is the time to shorten the index. We'll see. The Dow claimed a weekly win despite rounding off the week on a sour note, as investors assess whether Apple's decision to close some of its US stores in the midst of rising infections was a sign that parts of the US could be forced to roll back the easing of some restrictions to curtail growing outbreaks. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 0.8%. The S&P fell 0.62%, while the Nasdaq Composite was up just 0.03%. After hitting record highs intraday, Apple fell 1% as the tech giant announced that it would again close 11 stores across the US in Florida, North Carolina, South Carolina, and Arizona following a rise in coronavirus cases. And of course, the pandemic has infected more than 8.6 million people and killed more than 450,000 worldwide since late January, when it was first reported. The US is leading the death count, with 119,000 deaths and more than 2.2 million cases. The move from Apple appeared to exacerbate some investor concerns that an ongoing rise in virus cases could hamper the pace of economic reopening. Several states, including Arizona, California, Florida, Texas, and Oklahoma, reported record daily surges this week. Investors shun sectors of the market tied to the progress of the economic reopening, including energy, financials, and industrials. The volatility index was up 6.62% to 35.12, and gold futures for August delivery were up 1.47% to $1,756 an ounce. Crude oil for delivery in July rose 1.57% to $39.45, and the euro-US dollar was down 0.22% to 1.1177, while the US dollar index futures was up 0.24% to 97.63. Government debt rose above 100% of gross domestic product in May for the first time since 1963, reflecting a precipitous drop in economic output and a surge in spending to counter the fallout from the virus pandemic. Borrowing increased by more than £100 billion in the 2 months to May as tax revenue plunged and authorities deployed a massive support package to save jobs and keep businesses afloat during the lockdown. The pound suffered back-to-back weekly losses against the greenback for the first time in more than a month, and experts warn that the rout is far from over, as the risk of a no-deal Brexit and the potential for a second COVID-19 hit to the economy will offset monetary stimulus from the Bank of England. The pound US dollar fell 0.52% to $1.2360 and remains on track to post a second straight weekly loss for the first time since May the 10th. And the pound is likely to continue to cede ground to the dollar as the Bank of England's recent actions may not be enough to offset the economic impact from the virus. and the risks of a no-deal Brexit. The Bank of England decided earlier this week to slow the pace of its bond buying programme from the current rate of £10 to £11 billion per week. And the sour turn in sentiment on sterling followed better than expected UK retail sales that sparked some hopes that the economy was on the mend following reopening measures. The country is affected by the deadliest outbreak in Europe. Its shell-shocked economy may soon be facing a no-Brexit deal and potentially a second wave of the disease. Now down under, at the close in Sydney, the S&P ASX 200 rose 0.1%. The S&P ASX 200 VIX was up 1.08% to 24.25, and the Aussie was down 0.25% to 68.34. Australian retail turnover rose 16.3% in May, seasonally adjusted, according to preliminary data from the ABS. This is the largest seasonally adjusted rise ever published in the 38 years of the Retail Trade Survey, following the largest ever seasonally adjusted fall of 17.7% in April 2020. Turnover rose 5.3% when compared to May 2019. But these preliminary figures show rises in every industry. In percentage terms, the rises are particularly strong in industries that recorded low levels of trade in April. Well, there's no surprise there, I suppose. There were large rises for clothing, footwear and personal accessories retailing and cafes and restaurants and takeaway food services as restrictions on trade were lifted during May. But despite the rises, both these industries remain well down on the levels of May 2019. And there were also large rises in household goods retailing, where retailers reported increase in spending relating to homes, including furniture, home entertainment, home offices, and home improvement. Food retailing rose as households continued to consume additional food and beverages at home during May. And levels in liquor retailing remained high, as restrictions on hospitality such as bars, clubs and events remained in place for May 2020. And the minimum wage will increase by $13 a week, affecting the pay packets of more than 2.2 million Australians as the nation deals with its first recession in decades. The Fair Work Commission made the decision to lift the minimum wage by 1.75% on Friday, well down from the demands made by the union movement for a 4% increase. The increase takes the minimum wage to $753.80 per week, or $19.84 hourly rate. In making the decision, the Commission said the job market had faced an unprecedented shock caused by the pandemic, and the road to economic recovery remained uncertain. Despite the pressures facing employers, the Commission argued that if it did not increase wages, some families would be forced into poverty. Some low-paid households are plainly experiencing significant disadvantage, the FWC president said. An increase in minimum wages would assist these employees to better manage their needs. The Fair Work Commission has ordered the wage increase, though, to be phased in across different sectors. The first wave will come into effect on July the 1st for workers in industries that have not been as hard hit by the pandemic, such as healthcare, education, childcare, and other essential services. The second round of increases will begin at the start of November and the final stage in February next year, when workers in tourism, hospitality and retail will benefit. Union demands for a 4% increase were met with concern by the FWC. We've concluded that in the present economic circumstances, awarding an increase of the size proposed by the ACTU would pose a real risk of disemployment and of adversely affecting the employment opportunities for the low-skilled and young workers, they said. Sally McManus said the decision did not go far enough in supporting vulnerable workers, but said a pay rise was better than no increase. We would have liked to have seen more, of course, she said. But the fact that they've rejected the arguments of the employers about wage cuts, so effectively freezing wages, cutting wages, is a positive thing. The lowest wage workers, though, are still earning poverty wages. And Australia's official unemployment rate has been so corrupted in recent months, it's obscuring more about the labour market than it's revealing. It means we can no longer compare unemployment rates across time. There's no point creating a line graph to compare today's unemployment rate with the unemployment rates that peaked in the 1980s and 1990s. For instance, because it wouldn't be comparing apples with apples. It also means future economic historians will need to spend much more time explaining why, in May 2020, Australia's official unemployment rate didn't reflect reality. According to the Bureau of Statistics, the official unemployment rate jumped from 6.4% to 7.1% last month. The data shows that 227,700 jobs were lost in May, following 607,400 jobs lost in April, bringing the total number of jobs lost since March to 835,100. But the number of unemployed people has only increased by 211,000 since March. The remainder of the 835,100 have dropped out of the labour force altogether. Why would over 600,000 people drop out of the labour force in the last 2 months? Because they have become too discouraged to look for work, or they've been unable to work because they've been forced into an unpaid caring role at home. Due to the temporary COVID-19 rule changes, unemployed people also no longer need to be looking for work to claim Job Seeker. For the first time in many years, you can be classified as out of the labour force but still receive unemployment benefits. But since all of these people have stopped actively looking for work, they're no longer counted as officially unemployed. They've disappeared from the official figures. That explains why the participation rate fell to 62.9% last month, to the lowest level in nearly 20 years. And when the participation rate shrinks relative to the number of people who are employed, the official unemployment rate is kept artificially low. That's why the ABS estimated there were 927,600 unemployed Australians in May, when the government said earlier this month that there were more than 1.6 million people receiving JobSeeker. Economists say the official unemployment rate would be around 11.3% if everyone who lost their job in the last 2 months was still part of the labour force. And the unemployment rate peaked during the 1990s recession at 11.2%. Economists say another factor obscuring the true unemployment rate is the JobKeeper program. The JobKeeper's payments have kept hundreds of thousands of employees attached to their workplaces through the COVID-19 lockdown, but it means these people are still considered employed even if they haven't been working any hours. The official unemployment rate of 7.1% is also obscuring the reality of life for younger Australians. Youth employment, age 15 to 24, officially hit 16.1% last month, the highest level since mid-1997. But if every young Australian who had lost their job since March was counted as officially unemployed, rather than being forgotten when they drop out of the workforce, the youth unemployment rate would be 26.5%. And more than 290,000 people aged between 15 and 24 have dropped out of the labour force since March. The rate of youth underutilisation, which accounts for the number of unemployed and underemployed, is now over 37%. But that number would be 48% if everyone who'd lost their job was considered unemployed. Per capita, a progressive think tank says for the first time since the Great Depression, almost 2 in 3 young workers don't have enough work to meet their needs. True unemployment rates are likely to be obscured for months. Just last month, the Reserve Bank Philip Lowe said Australia's unemployment rate was not the best indicator of the health of the labour market at the moment. And that's kind of an understatement central bankers have perfected. But he also said the JobKeeper program may have to be extended if the workforce requires it. He warned Australia's economy would hit a critical point in September when a raft of stimulus measures stopped, and it was very important not to withdraw fiscal stimulus too early. If the economy did not see a recovery fairly soon, the risk of permanent damage to the labour market would rise, he said. At this stage, Prime Minister Scott Morrison is still planning to end JobKeeper in September, with plans to transition workers from the JobKeeper program to possibly an increased JobSeeker from that point, which will see the official unemployment rate rise. The government has started slowly reintroducing mutual obligation requirements for JobSeekers from the 9th of June. Those on the dole have been required to undertake at least one appointment with their employment services provider, and in coming months, they will also be required to start looking for work, and penalties such as the suspension of JobSeeker payments will be reintroduced. But until that happens, it means a true picture of the labour market will remain obscured for months. And economists, including Philip Lowe and the Treasury, are just guessing where the jobless rate may be by the end of this year. Where the labour market goes from here is difficult to outline given the definition of unemployment, uncertainty about what firms will do when JobKeeper is wound back, as well as the fact that the economy is doing better than expected, EY's chief economist Joe Masters observed. And that's without considering the future vagaries of a virus that caught most of the world well and truly off guard, and the risk of a second wave. And according to the ABC, the Reserve Bank of Australia considered asking private firms to stop telling Australians about slumping property prices when the early period of coronavirus panic stoked fears of a housing market crash. In a release of highly classified documents from inside Australia's central bank, economists discussed the need to treat the housing market as dysfunctional and potentially shut down data sources, letting investors know. Lindsay David, the founder of LF Economics, said it was shocking that the central bank would contemplate asking private sector data collectors to stop informing the public. I personally think it's absolutely disgraceful conduct by the RBA that they have appeared to resort to giving what appears to be a manipulation of the information members of the public do and do not have access to in relation to house prices and debt. Stopping perceptions of a crash in April, economist Nick Garvin wrote to colleagues warning them the bank should stop analysing the housing market as if it were operating normally and calling for a halt as happens to stop market trading in emergencies. I think it's dangerous for regulators to be reporting on housing prices as though the market is currently functioning, he wrote, because real estate agents could not operate normally at the time. Auctions and viewings were banned or highly restricted, the economist argued. So, paused would be a fairer classification. And he went on, we should also tell private sector data providers to follow this rule. If people started mistakenly thinking that we're experiencing a housing crash, it's not going to help things. Now, CoreLogic denies that the RBA demanded that they remove their data. The key private sector provider of information about real estate in Australia is probably global giant CoreLogic, formerly RP Data. Its daily index stopped being published on May the 20th. The spread of the virus across Australia could see unemployment reach about 10% and house prices drop 20%, said one economist. But CoreLogic's head of research, Tim Lawless, denied it was because the RBA demanded it. We received no correspondence from any of our clients asking for our market-facing indicators to be removed from publication, he said in a statement. The decision to remove the daily index series from publication on the CoreLogic website was a cautionary move made due to concerns about the potential for volatility in the daily series at a time when sales activity had fallen by around one-third in a month. This was a prudent decision at the time when sales observations had fallen sharply, Mr. Lawless said. The company had continued to publish an end-of-month index, and production of daily data has been continuing unseen by the public and was republished at the end of last week. Property analysts are gobsmacked the RBA would consider reducing the transparency of information in a key investment market, particularly in an emergency period. Quite frankly, as a property market information supplier, I'm alarmed by intended communications for private data providers to follow, SQM Research Managing Director Louis Christopher said. Was this prompting the real reason why CoreLogic suspended their daily index from public viewing shortly after? This raises serious questions on the independence market data providers have with the RBA, he said. Not surprisingly, the RBA declined to respond to further questions. But Edwin Almeida and I discussed the resurrection of the index in our post, The Index is Back or Not. Edwin was on sparkling form, and I recommend this for a little light relief. And by the way, the data to the 18th of June shows that prices fell over the past week in Sydney, down 0.17%, Melbourne, 0.28%, Brisbane rose 0.03%, Adelaide fell 0.1%, Perth was down 0.59%, and the majors together were down 0.21%. Over the quarter, Sydney fell 0.08%, and Melbourne was down 1.84%, while Brisbane was up 0.58% and Adelaide was up 0.94%, but Perth dropped 0.8% and the major five fell 0.53%. From peak, prices are down 3% in Sydney, 1.3% in Melbourne, up 2.6% in Brisbane and 1.3% in Adelaide, down 21.5% in Perth, and down 2.2% across the major five. And as I often warn, these are averages, which do not reflect the significant variations across locations and property types, where top-end prices and apartment prices, along with off-the-plan prices, are all falling fast. The CoreLogic Index may well not yet be showing these recent falls, so expect more downward movement ahead. Before I go, a quick reminder that our guest on DFA's Tuesday regular live stream event will be Robbie Barwick from the Citizens Party. We'll be discussing banking reform, and maybe even China will get a mention. You can send a question in beforehand via the DFA blog or on the night using the YouTube chat. We'll see you there. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.